We are doing this month more of like a topical Sunday to Sunday. I think Lauren called it fresh bread, the idea of just letting each of our teachers through November get up and speak kind of what they're learning, what God is teaching them right now. And so, you know, fresh bread, I think that maybe today is a little bit more half-baked bread. So I apologize for that. But thinking this was kind of like a stream of consciousness talk for me, and thinking about what am I learning, and realizing I really am learning some good things. Just through the last couple messages, I think I learned some really good things in Song of Solomon as we studied that. And what I mean is like God really speaking to me. And I love that. I think that sometimes there can be a misperception. We, like, whoever's standing up here has somehow figured this out and is now trying to get all of you guys to where I am. And that just is not the case. If I'm ahead of you, it's by like an hour. And like a lot of this is really honestly things that I'm desiring to know more. And that idea in the last song about seeing God's face, how important that is. And I think that we spend a life finding more and more truths. But and I've talked about this, how reality has this sense of growing. As our faith grows, God grows, things get bigger, and how important this is. There's an article in Vanity Fair this month about the top 50 disruptors. And the title of that caught my eye. And these are guys, you know, number one, like Jeff Bezos is out of, you say, you know, you've got all the guy that's running Amazon and pushing kind of this new approach to consumption. You've got the guys that are now kind of at the forefront of Apple. You've got still Facebook and Zuckerberg's thing. And, you know, these are the guys that they called disruptors. And it's almost a new way of looking at innovation. And these are like the inventors. But disruption, it's an interesting term. It's like what jars us out of our paradigm so that we're able to see something bigger. And disruption, I think, from a technological standpoint, is looked at as a healthy thing, right? The disruptors, there's something very powerful about that. And then I was thinking, gosh, you know, how does that fit, let's say, into the world of faith? What is our view of disruption as it pertains to faith? And I don't know if we have that same sort of appreciation for hard questions or people that challenge the paradigms or look at things in a new way. I think that there can be a tendency for us to like go, hey, back off. And yet I think Jesus was like the disruptor. And this was just part of his brilliance in his teaching. We've talked about this plenty before, that he never gave anybody a straight answer. I think they say like three times he just told them, okay, here's the answer to your question. And usually he went, oh, I've got a better question. Think about this. Or you know what, this reminds me of this little story. Or you know what, let's look at this like object lesson right here, right, as a way of challenging, disrupting in a sense. But I think always with this desire that things would get bigger. I think of, you know, maybe some of this is just my own baggage. I think as a kid, I always was sort of wired towards questions. I took this little profile thing one time, and it was talking about how you learn, and it was saying, Jeff, you learn by asking why. And this kind of drove my parents nuts. They would, my sisters just loved Jesus, and then here's little Jeff going like, And I don't know if that's ever totally changed, but underneath all of that, I was thinking is a couple driving assumptions for me. And I think that one of them is that truth, if it's truth, is not intimidated of questions, right? That truth, if it's really true, it can stand up for itself. So you can fire questions at it all day long, and it's like, bring it on, right? I love Paul's statement, question everything and cling to the good. And I think that's right. How do we do that? I think that's kind of what I want to talk about a little bit today. But I think the other assumption that's underneath it for me is this fundamental belief that reality out there makes sense, that it's good. And when we look at things, we look at questions, when we struggle and wrestle with things in our faith, that we probably aren't seeing things clearly. I think that's it. When we look at this and go, this doesn't make sense, that rather than saying, well, I'm going to discard it and move on, instead, it requires more of a reexamination. And maybe we don't all have all the data, right? And so we can keep pressing in, because ultimately I think what we're going to find there is something deeper, something more meaningful. It reminds me, Einstein has that classic phrase that God doesn't play dice with the universe. And under all his study of science and quantum mechanics, there was this commitment that ultimately in the end it makes sense. And I think that's part of the faith I feel in the questions, is that when we face disruptions in there, it's with a hopefulness that what we're going to find out there that's bigger is also good. It's better. And I think Scripture is all about this, stories of disruption over and over, lives that, like, they were going to start on this trajectory and then everything seemed to go wrong. I was just teaching a few weeks ago with a high school and junior high on Joseph. And I think what a perfect example of this, that you're looking and God's giving this kid a vision over here of who you're going to be, and then everything goes south. Everything goes wrong. And his heart is just beaten and beaten and beaten until all of a sudden here he is now in this place where he's exalted. And God goes, see? Not that God did all of these things, but God somehow brilliantly works with all of man's junk and brings this around and does something magnificent, something beautiful, something redemptive. I think of what you do, Mark, and you tell those stories, and like you said, of this girl and the reconnecting with her mother. You look at a story like that, and in it is pain, and in it is difficulty, and yet the final outcome somehow is bigger, more beautiful, more meaningful. There's a great passage in James that you guys are, I'm sure, all familiar with. And we're going to be in James today. Pastor Jay taught a little bit out of James last week. And James just goes like, look, in the first chapter, he says, count it all joy when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And that idea of counting it joy, I think there's a discipline in that. Because usually when these disruptions happen, they're anything but joyful. And yet there's opportunity in these trials to do a tremendous amount of work. And I was thinking, kind of these two things. I think that trials, they teach us. They teach us where, you know, like our circle has become too small, where our belief system has become too compact. And they get us outside of that. But I think they simultaneously do something internally to make us examine ourselves. And when we face these disruptions, whether it's a word from Jesus that we come across in Scripture, whether it's a trial that we face in life where, gosh, this just doesn't make sense. And God, I thought you were doing this, and why am I facing this? Or God, I thought you were going to provide, and where is this coming from? Or all of a sudden, you know, I acted out in obedience, and the bottom just dropped out of the situation. And God is saying, look, I'm going to show you who I am, but I'm also going to get some of your junk out of there at the same time. And so what happens in disruption is that our motives get exposed. And this is never really fun. We see our own weaknesses, which we would rather not look at. And I think we often see our own shallowness, which is painful to see. The feeling, I think, is like if somebody posts a picture on Facebook of you that you don't like and you want to delete it. right? There you are, and that's you, and that's what you looked like, and you're thinking, I don't want anybody to see that photo, right? And this sort of like, I want to control the image of what people see. And we all do that. I think we're all wired that way. In a sense, it makes perfect sense that we would do that because we know how much people depend on outward appearances. And so we all become masters at doing this, at our own sort of self-advertising. But the thing is that we can do that to such an extent that we buy into it ourselves. So the testing brings illumination. It brings light into the situation. And I really think that almost like the majority of the spiritual walk, success-wise, has to do with our willingness to sit there being exposed. That we know that it's God that works in us, that it's God that perfects us, it's God that works in all of these circumstances. And what is up to us seems to be this opportunity to remain right there and let him do it. I don't know if there's anything more than that. But you realize how difficult it is that in these moments of exposure and these moments of disruption, when life changes and it shifts, all we want to do is flee back into a place of control, a place of safety, and a place where we feel like we've got it all figured out. But there's an opportunity in this, not just to see God bigger, but to like get beyond and out of the confines of the way that this world operates. And there's this two things from the book of Hebrews, two statements that I just think are so poetic and beautifully worded, that in Hebrews it talks about people who walk in a manner that the world is not worthy of. And in these disruptions is like this opportunity to break out of this gravitational pull, right? Where we're operating by a physics that doesn't fit anymore. People look and go, wait, how is this happening? How are you living your life with this fruit? How are you not bitter? How are you not frustrated? How do you have this peace? How do you have this gentleness? And to go, this is the work that God is doing in our hearts when it says he's perfecting. Right? This is like the image of Christ being formed in us. Paul says he's in labor pains till every believer has Christ formed inside of them. The other one that I like from Hebrews is this idea of their country not being this world but a distant country. And so we're learning to walk in light of a kingdom with a whole different set of rules. And as we remain there, God's saying, stay there. This will change everything. So learning to be, like, changed in these situations is accepting the fact that our course, our trajectory, is one towards greater humility, right? And I see this. I think my kids are like the best disruptors in my life. And man, when I think of my resources in getting things done, I can barely make it through homework time each day when it's just me. When it's Jeff going home and I'm going to get all the kids to get done all these things to get their rooms cleaned and these, I fall to pieces. And I think God is going like, good. It's a great place for you to be, Jeff, right there, to see that all you've got is this little bread and fish, and that's all that you can contribute to this, is something so meager. And in that becomes the opportunity to really shift into a position of dependence. So this is one of the things exposure does. It exposes our weaknesses and our deficiencies, but hopefully shifts us into a different gear of one of dependence. And in recognizing our dependence, I think that we realize that the opportunities that God gives are often just a simple shift of focus. I think it's amazing how, like, simply waking up a few minutes early and reading a chapter of Proverbs can radically affect your whole day, right? That the complexity to this, it's not complex. In fact, it's often very simple. that simple adjustments and remaining in God, really the burden he's given us to walk, it's a small one that he bears with us if we can shift our focus. And so sometimes it's just these simple adjustments that get us back on track. Sometimes it's just as simple as a question. I've talked about how I meet with a lady that does spiritual direction, and she will ask me this question, Jeff, where was God in this situation? And you go, oh gosh, like not at all on my radar. Because I'm in a situation and it's hard and I've got to figure this out myself. And so, man, it's up to me. And what am I going to do and how am I going to handle my resources? And you see God going, Jeff, what are you doing? What are you doing? And this is the simple power of the adjustment that happens and the disruptions. But there's always a choice. This is always something that God so respectfully, he refuses to force our gaze to be towards him. And so what happens instead is I think that all this kind of internal stuff starts welling up to the surface, like fear. And we've got to learn to recognize these things as like these beautiful warning lights that are going off on our dashboard, right? Fear being one of them. When that light goes on, that's like the oil light going on. Bing, fear. And you go, oh, what's going on in my heart? Because God makes it clear, like, that's not from me, right? I've not given you a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Is that good? God's saying in that situation, I think sometimes we feel like when we're defending our own paradigms, they're like these Jenga towers. You ever play Jenga? And like, don't jar this because the whole thing's going to collapse. And God's going, nah, don't worry, you're fine. And this is the thing, that as those kind of feelings well up in us, we realize that oftentimes what we're defending is ourselves. Defending our egos, defending our comfortable worlds. And see, we have got this God that is never going to let us stay and remain right there. Like the whole faith walk, when do we have the opportunity of opting out of it? And God goes, never. I'm going to stay after you all the way to the end. And so I think the more that we can become self-aware of what's going on, I think the better off we'll be. I put a quote on Facebook. This was my little disruption for the week that says, nothing true can be said about God from a posture of defense. That's not mine. That's Marilynne Robinson. And I read that and I thought, wow, gosh, that's interesting. Like the posture of defense. And certainly there are things about God that we can defend, right, that are true. But that posture of defense is a way of looking into asking us the question, what are we really defending here? And I think that when God comes in and disrupts our systems, he's saying, look, that's your ego, Jeff, that you're holding on to. That's your way of seeing it. And so when I respond with a harsh word, when I respond in a way that kind of attacks back, it's usually not God I'm defending, but me. There's a great quote by Lewis. Put up that one on the dog. This one I love. He says, no man who says, I'm as good as you, believes it. He would not say it if he did. The St. Bernard never says it to the toy dog, nor the scholar to the dunce, nor the employable to the bum, nor the pretty woman to the plain. The claim to equality outside the strictly political field is made only by those who feel themselves to be in some way inferior. What it expresses is precisely the itching, smarting, writhing awareness of an inferiority that the patient refuses to accept and therefore resents. And I was thinking about this. I like this quote by Lewis because it's a great way of identifying not just our fearful responses, but our defensive responses. And I say this not like pointing a finger at anybody here, but saying I think that sometimes I look at this in Christendom, let's say, and I think that so often the tone of our conversation tends to be like striking back, or there's an edge to it. And I think it so misrepresents God's heart. I think that God is pushing us in a different direction when James says that these disruptions make us perfect and complete, lacking nothing. This is like the antithesis of where we're supposed to be going. that the wisdom from above, the wisdom that changes us has got this meekness. And we're going to look at a passage on that in just a sec. But I think it first requires us, as Teresa of Avila says, to just sit in our weeds. Sit in our weeds with God. To allow that light and that examination to see our stuff places us in this position of humility, which is, I think, a position that we're never supposed to leave. We're never supposed to leave that spot. And a couple weeks ago, Lauren was talking about the story of the prodigal son. And that older son, and I think that's like the cliffhanger in that story. We see the younger son who leaves and returns home in this beautiful redemption, and then you've got the older son who's standing outside in frustration. And the story ends going, who knows, does he come inside or not? And I think that missed opportunity of the older son to me has been like weighing on my heart as well. And the father going, everything I have is yours. Everything, every day. And are we living our lives in such a way that we are experiencing the goodness of what the Father has to offer? Or have we just become dutiful and have this whole comparative system in our minds? I was thinking, you know, I think coming to Christ is like applying to Harvard when you know that you don't have what it takes and finding out that you're accepted and that you're in. And like, wow, you get this letter back and it's like, you've got it. Come to Harvard. Like, wow, thank you, you know? And then you finish your first year, and then you look back at next year at the incoming class, and you're like, why did they let that guy in? And like going, no. All you think every single day is, I'm lucky to be here, right? I'm just lucky to be here. How do you come to that table with that sense of appreciation? And we have just this tendency towards nearsightedness. Small worlds. We talk about this idea of myopia. We just can only see this right here. And that constantly our reality, God is trying to draw it back. I was just talking to Raya. We were talking about Joshua and how Joshua comes across this angel that's dressed as a warrior. And Joshua says, are you for us or are you for our enemies? And the angel says, neither. And I think, oh, I love that statement, right? Like, God, are you for me or are you for that guy? And God's going, neither. Like, who are you for, Jeff? Right? And there's like a shift in perspective of going, oh my gosh, this is bigger. This is bigger. And that place of humility, like, wisdom begins with the fear of the Lord. Wisdom begins with that posture of like, wow, I'm just lucky to be here. And I think sometimes that's what God's working against is our own like sort of internal heart, our pride, our need to control. And so we've got story after story. I mean, I think the greatest of these is probably in James. And that picture, not James, Job. We're reading James, but the story of Job. And the story is about like Job going through the biggest disruption that's probably ever been faced in mankind. And this trial happening because Job is like the top of the class. I mean, God's going, have you considered Job? Like, he's brilliant. And so his whole life gets uprooted. And all Job's friends come and go, you've clearly done something wrong. Because this has got to fit in our neat little theological box. And God's going, no, these guys are all wrong. And what I'm doing, Job, is stretching your mind. And I'm going to do this by showing you your dependence, but then showing you just who I am. A bigger picture of the Father's face. And the book concludes with this beautiful passage where Job says, I know you can do all things, that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Herein I will speak, I will question you, and you make it known to me. I had heard of you by hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. And I think that, right there in a nutshell, is the path God has all of us on. And we've heard of this, but he's going, oh, I'm going to show you. I want you to see it. And in the disruptions, not only does it put us in this place of proper humility, but it gives us the opportunity to see God for who he is. And again, I think a lot of it is how we respond to this light. John is, I think, so good at that, at capturing the essence of this light comes into darkness. And this is what it's like. This revelation comes like beams of light into these situations. And then the question becomes, how will you respond? I want to read a section from a book I've been reading with some friends, and it's by this guy, Christian Wiman. And the guy's a poet. Next one. And I think he writes so beautifully, and so I just wanted to read this to you. It's such a wonderful passage. But he says, when I assented to the faith that was latent within me, and I phrase it carefully, deliberately, for there was no white light, no ministering or avenging angel that tore my life in two. Rather, it seemed as if the tiniest seed of belief had finally flowered in me, or more accurately, as if I had happened upon some rare flower deep in the desert that had known, though I was just discovering it, that it had been blooming impossibly year after parched year within me, surviving all the seasons of my unbelief. When I assented to the faith that was latent within me, what struck me were the ways in which my evasions and confusions, which I had mistaken for a strong sense of purpose, had expressed themselves in my life. Poem after poem about unnamed and unnameable absences, relationships so transparently perishable they practically came within expiration dates on them, city after city sacked of impressions and peremptorily abandoned, as if I were some conquering army of insight seeing, I now see nothing. Perhaps it is never disbelief, which at least is active and conscious, that destroys a person, but unacknowledged belief, or a need for belief so strong that it is continually and silently crucified on the crosses of science, humanism, art, or, to name the thing that poisons all these gifts from God, the overweening self. There's a lot in there, and he is such a poet. But I love this, that he talks about how he had almost romanticized his unbelief, and yet it grew in his heart like this undeniable flower that was there. It makes me think of when we were studying Colossians, like Christ is all and in all, and how we respond to that work. That we can over-dramatize these situations or write these beautiful poems of unbelief, but really what this is the pride of the self refusing to look. Refusing to accept what God is doing. And so I think that really at the heart of this, this key to this is this meekness that God is after, this submission. The light comes in, and how do we respond? Do we push it out, or do we let it in, and do we remain? And the people of faith, it's interesting. There's a number of people that over the years I've really respected as, say, theologians, who you watch the course of their life and the trajectory of their life, and towards the end, they get softer. Billy Graham, for one. John Stott. Eugene Peterson. These, like, deep theologians who, at the end of their life, you see this gentleness sort of creep in. I read somebody who said they become more feminine, which is, I think, a compliment to women. Because I love the softening that I see in these men. They're a little bit more open-handed. John Stott goes, gosh, I have more questions than answers. But he says it with such peace in his heart. Things have gotten bigger, and yet there's this sense that, like, he knows more. And so when Jay was reading from James 3, you know, I glanced down at the last part of that, 13 through 18, and wanted to just read these verses to you because they struck me as so beautiful. says, "Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." Isn't that a great passage? This is the wisdom from above. We talked about the physics of this world and the spiritual, like, world that we have here, which I feel like karma is a really good way of kind of describing that. You know, you do something bad, you're going to get something bad. You do something good, you might get something good. And yet God is saying, no, there is a greater world. And what operates in that world are things like grace that upend the spiritual physics of this earth. And God's revelation comes in and it upends our own little worlds, where God is teaching us deeper and deeper truth about how he operates, about how redemption really looks. And he's going, the antithesis of this is jealousy and selfish ambition, right? And that stuff creeps in. There's a whole religious form of that as well. You see it so clearly in the world around the strategizing and the competition. And you see God saying, like, no, that stuff is earthly, right? You walk in a manner that the world is not worthy of. But that is this kind of open-handedness. Jay talked last week about the power of words, which is how James leads right into this, and how these words have that same sort of power of bringing incredible blessing. And you felt that after church last Sunday, just a sense of warmth and of love. And yet these words can also bring about a curse. James says they're like demonic words that can scar us so deeply. And he describes, no, the wisdom from above, here's how you get the texture of it. And I love this. He says, first, it's pure. And I think he means that in contrast to the self, that as we're growing and God is showing us who he is, he's saying one of the tests of that, as we're sitting there in these situations going, Lord, is this you? He's going, well, is it pure? Because that's the texture of how revelation comes. That's how light is felt, by its purity. We were reading in our Bible study this last week from Psalm 19, how it talks about the commandments of the Lord are pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The rules of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, even much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and the drippings of the honeycomb. And I love that. As we're growing, as God is teaching us new things, this is one of the tests, is how does it feel? Is it clean? That God's truth comes and it's clean. Second, this kind of wisdom is peaceable. And we can learn a lot from that. But it's not, there's a guy, Hugh Ross, that I like, and he says, no, it's not about peacekeeping. Peacekeeping is going like, okay, you two just go to your opposite corners and relax. But peacemaking is coming in and helping both sides see the truth. So there's not a diminishing or a hiding of the light, but there's realizing when it comes in, it's not taking one side or the other, which is why later on there he says it's impartial. But it's also gentle, mild, kind, tender, this gentle wisdom. And this is the trajectory God has for us. As he's disrupting our lives, he's saying, this is who I want you to be. Open to reason, which means actually listening, not just thinking of what you're going to say next. I'm so guilty of that. As I'm formulating and thinking, we did this exercise this last week of mirroring It's so painful. I want to like give some kind of commentary, you know, like, oh, I've got, that reminds me of this, or I've got something to add to that. And mirroring is just simply saying back to somebody else what they already said. And you realize that so often we get caught up in presenting, or I get caught up in presenting what I think, as opposed to really listening, really being open, full of mercy and good fruits. I love that too, compassion and forgiveness. There's a quote by Simone Weil where she says, all the natural movements of the soul are controlled by laws analogous to those of physical gravity. Grace is the only exception. And I love that idea that this mercy of the kingdom of heaven goes against physics. Things get bigger somehow. And you wouldn't expect that, but this is true. And I've had this even just a couple times recently with a couple people that I've had to apologize to. Things that all of a sudden dawned on me and I went, oh my goodness, what have I done? And my thought is simply like, well, is there any way that I can get this back to where it was? And God's saying, no, 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 my kingdom works different than that. If you humble yourself, through forgiveness, things get bigger. That love enters into that equation, that things grow. Isn't that amazing? It's not what you would expect, right? Forgiveness and mercy, it creates energy. And I think of a couple things that I've learned as I've kind of sat in this place for the last couple weeks. And I want to just share this with you kind of in closing. So again, when I said kind of a stream of consciousness talk, you've been just watching me meander through my journal here, basically. But as we sit there, you know, one of the last words in there is it says sincere. The wisdom from above is sincere. And how much we have this tendency to just edit what we say. And that's, you know, you get why that's smart, right? But you're always kind of saying, well, what? How much can I let you know? Instead of just like a transparency or an honesty that I think sincerity has got that connotation. But as you sit there before God in that sincerity, as you sit there in your weeds, as you sit there in your limitations and your humility, what you find in the face of God that's revealed to you there is a God who is totally for you. And I was sitting there last week in a time of just being quiet and had just this deep sense of how much God likes me, not loves me, right? And there's a difference in that. Like, love is like, well, you know, a father's got to love his child. And like is like, oh, I like this about you. In your limitations or your quirkiness or the way that you are. Like, this is you. I like who you are. And that idea of God being totally for you, what a necessary reminder. As God gets bigger, like we get bigger. As we get bigger, God gets bigger. And that sense of you being exactly who he's called you to be is such a beautiful and freeing thing. And as God is disrupting us, it's freeing us. It's ridding us of these chains. It's ridding us of these like false lies and of this self-marketing nonsense and just setting you free to be who you are, perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And it takes time. This last verse that we read from James, a harvest of righteousness is sown by peace by those who make peace. My wife just tore out the whole garden and planted the next crop, and I was looking at a seed package, and one of them says it takes 100 days before anything grows. I was thinking, we just do not have the patience. I don't have, like, 100 days? Like, just go buy a full-grown plant, stick it in the ground, like... We serve this God who plants these seeds and plants them in peace, and they begin to take root and they grow. I love that, these seeds that are planted in peace. And the work that God is doing as we remain in these situations, as we sit in the light, as we sit in our weeds, as we see God tending this garden, allowing things to bloom, allowing us to grow. And so, in closing, I want to close with a prayer that I wrote. This is Jeff's attempt at a Celtic prayer. And there's something so beautiful about the prayers that they would write, because they saw so much of like God's hand and power in nature and the way that it was exposed. And so anyway, this was a lesson that we were doing. And I had had such like a touching moment in looking into this piece of art. Okay, this is going to sound very goofy. But looking at this piece of art that was this shepherd's staff, and there was this lamb. But what I saw was this beautiful barrel, like you're surfing. And I know. And yet it was like this glimpse of like looking ahead and the beauty, and then seeing like this lamb kind of at the end of it. And it was so touching, because I thought, my heart leaps at that, the beauty of that. And God going like, Jeff, I want you, when your heart leaps, I want you to see me. I don't want you to turn those into these like false little idols that you cling to. When your heart leaps, I want you to make that connection all the way to me. And this idea of remaining in those situations, seeing that side of God's love, that side of his acceptance and affirmation, and wanting to remain there, I wrote this little prayer, and I'll close with this. This is Jeff's Celtic prayer. It's called I Remain. I wrote, I remain tucked in this swirling vortex, crouched under a mighty wall of water, poised to act or react, focused on the light ahead. I remain in awe of your beauty, speechless at the glory, overwhelmed at the complexity, and hopeful. I remain resolved against caution, challenged to go deeper, committed to push myself further, desirous to take it all in. Christ is the leap in my heart, the swell beneath my feet, the shield above my head, the light before my eyes, the life in every pore. The end.